You're listening to an edited version of the live Voices of Montana statewide radio program. Find us on Facebook and subscribe for further podcasts wherever you get your audio on demand. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program. Thanks for joining us, and please feel free to contact me at studio@voicesofmontana.com.
Kind of forgotten about the Timber Wars of the 90s. Started talking to Bruce Vincent and started looking it up again. And man, oh man, those were some times. We had high inflation. You know, if we want to trace back to where we're going to find an answer to this simple question, you're watching it all burn. Isn't there a better way than watching it all burn? It is a long story. Timber management, front and center focus nowadays. And maybe we're ready for this reset now. I think there's avenues we can come together on. Let's talk about timber in Montana with Bruce Vincent today on Voices.
It's time for the fastest hour in radio. From Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz. Call in today at 866-627-5483 or text a comment or question to 781-627-5483. Now, rolling out the barrel of fun, it's Tom Schultz.
Whose voice is that?
I don't know.
Is that Josh Rath, the most excellent in-studio engineer?
Some guy that just works on a radio station and talks all day.
Yeah, that's Josh Rath. He's still around here. He's still a thorn in many people's sides.
Yeah, what the listeners don't know is we tied up Eric. We threw him on the Northern News Network today, and I'm over here now.
Yeah, so pray for me.
Yes.
Thank you all for being here. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. And here it is, Monday. Can't trust that day. Well, whatever it is, just get kicking it, okay? It is the work week. Get kicking it. I think it was Alan Olson who was on, and it was like a Friday or something. And I was just all happy and bubbly. And he goes, wow, all that energy. What do you like on a Monday? And I said, I'm dragging my butt around a lot on Monday. And that's the case. It certainly is. Anyway, thanks again for being here. Tom Schultz alongside, two decades strong, working on three. That is Voices of Montana. And over those two decades strong, working on three, we've seen a lot of changes in the timber industry. A lifelong Montanan myself, grew up in eastern Montana, spent 30 years in western Montana, kind of know the landscape a little bit. But when you ask that simple question about isn't there a better way than watching it burn? And we've been tangling with the issues of improper forest management, or maybe misguided forest management, or maybe just not enough forest management. We ask those questions, and you know, there are a lot of things come up, but there's a few things that surface to the top an awful lot, and that's the fact that we can't even get in our forests for a lot of reasons. I don't know if that's the main reason why we are experiencing what we have been experiencing over the past few years. I know you're looking at the drier climate. That does play a lot. That is not not part of the equation here. It is part of the equation. But what I want to be part of the equation is if this is what we're facing right now and we have some methods and some ways to get in there and not let it all burn like it is, a lot of studying out there. In fact, there was a new report in the Billings Gazette today, and I didn't get a chance to finish it. It talked about, you know, just another study out there. Bruce Vincent is with us here, and I was speaking about Bruce last week. Went up there as we were on the Toll Rope Tour, visited in Libby, Montana, had a chance to catch up with Bruce, and went out and looked at a reclamation site, the tailings pond for the Troy Mine, which is actually a pretty good project at this point right now. And then we also started talking about forests. How could we not? He's internationally known. He's a speaker, and of course, expert in, and a third generation Libby Logger too, a forest expert. Bruce Vincent joins us today. Bruce, good morning to you, sir. How's it going?
Good morning, Tom. It's going well. We had a little bit of moisture over the night, and I can see the sky again instead of just smoke.
I know. I was up there, and I missed all those beautiful Cabinet Mountains in your area.
Yeah, they were still there. You just couldn't see them.
Let's start with this, and it's condolences out to friends that you have in Libby, and of course a member of the community there. They're going to be friends with a lot of people. There was a plane crash in southern Minnesota that claimed the life of a surgeon from Omaha, Nebraska, and two Libby folks too. And I'm sorry that this news comes up for you here, Bruce, today. It was 42-year-old Jacob Mertis, and this has been published, so families and relatives have been notified. 42-year-old Jacob Mertis and 37-year-old Sarah Mertis both of Libby. Sarah was a physician at Cabinet Peaks Medical Center, and Jacob worked as a sanitarian and planner for the Lincoln County Health Department there. And so I'm sorry, Bruce. My condolences to all our friends and family in Libby, Montana.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's a big hit. Anybody that lives in a small, isolated town knows how central to healthcare the doctors are, particularly young, progressive, vigorous doctors like Sarah was. And her and Jake were thoroughly involved in the whole community, and it's gonna leave a big hole.
Yeah. I'm sorry. The hurt continues. For Libby, you know, we go to the forest, Bruce, and how would you characterize our current forest management? Are we just laying up short in little areas? Is it because we can't get in there? Are we not doing all the math that we need to do on it? Watching these trees burn, there is a better way, and we need to start answering that question.
Yeah, and that overall question of how do we give the public what they claim they want with the forest? And most folks want a healthy forest. How to get to a healthy forest requires backing up quite a ways to look at the whole history of forests in Montana. And where I live, that means going back 15,000 years to the ice cap. 15,000 years ago, we didn't have any trees. We had a mile of ice. And as the ice cap was receding, the landscape started to be populated with trees, and humans have been managing those trees for thousands of years. The Native Americans were heavy managers. So when the public looks at the forest and thinks it's beautiful, it ought to be left alone, if we just let nature do the managing, we come out with a beautiful outcome. We're seeing the downside to that because we have no idea what natural management looks like other than a great deal of fire. So it's a complex issue. The public is rightfully concerned about what's going on in the forest. But getting from where we are right now, which is an overstocked, unhealthy forest, to where the public wants, which is a public or a healthy, resilient forest, is going to take a lot of work between the people that manage the land and the public that is overseeing that management.
I'm optimistic, too. And maybe I'll start with that optimism because we see the effects of mismanaged forests. I don't know if it's bad policy, it's a combination of things. I suppose we can get into that, too. But it seems like there's more of a recognition of this among those circles that are decidedly... Oh, just environmental. And of course, we like you say, we all want a healthy forest. I guess the question is, are we to a point where now we're going to link arms instead of clench our fists?
I think so, and it's been a long time coming. The writing began to be put down and easy to see in the late 80s when the litigation started on every forest management attempt on national forest land. In the late 80s, the lawsuits and appeals started with a great deal of vigor. And there were a number of people who weighed in on the discussion of what our forests ought to look like. And some of the folks that weighed in with a three-word vision for our forests have stopped doing that. They started suing to halt forest management. And because of some past practices, the public got behind that move. They didn't like looking at forest management. And that was the beginning of the timber wars that you mentioned in the startup there.
Mm-hmm.
The forest communities could see what was going on, that the litigation was going to start choking down the management ability of the federal agencies. So timber communities started to respond and fight back. And we did a great deal of fighting. I was a leader in that fight. It took us quite a while to figure out that there was a difference between fighting and leading. And while we were fighting, we were not helping our cause at all. We were the public wanted to save the forest, what we needed to be talking with them about was, what does that look like? Because right now, they have saved the forest to death. For the first time in recorded history, the forests in Montana are dying faster than they're growing, because the forests are overstocked. And we've got a huge issue facing the public. But finally, after three decades, the public is recognizing this. We've got folks that used to be throwing rocks at each other now sitting around tables and talking about, what do we want the forest in Montana to look like in 20 or 50 or 100 or 200 years? So we're at a tipping point right now, and I have a great deal of hope for the future. We've just got a lot of work to do before we get there.
I appreciate how you said you were fighting, not leading, and now so you had to reevaluate as loggers. Let's just say it's loggers versus environmentalists, and that's not fair. But just for comparison's sake, you guys have reevaluated. There were some practices you noted as well, past practices that were maybe not as environmentally conscious as they need to be. I think the forest industry, and again, I have said this, I appreciate environmentalism for making awareness and also ultimately changing, but the pendulum seems to have swung an awful lot. Has there been honest, open recognition in the environmental industry of the damage that they are causing because of their current practices when it comes to sue and settle and sue and sue?
Yeah, I think there is. There's recognition throughout the, I call it the conservation community or the real environmental community. And I count myself in that. I led the first Earth Day in Libby. I was in middle school when we picked up crap in the creek going by the middle school. I am an environmentalist. Most loggers are.
Yes.
We love the forest, and the health of the forest is central to our ability to carve out a future for us and for future generations. So we are environmentalists, and we have found that the true conservation and environmental groups that live with us in our rural timber communities want to have a solution. What we didn't recognize early on and what generated the timber wars is we found out that there's an entire industry that's been built on the fight. I call it the environmental conflict industry. And they make money when we're fist fighting. That's what finally woke me and others up in our timber communities. We were having convoys and rallies, and we were making sure that America knew we had an issue in our rural forest communities. But there was an industry that was using that. We were fighting, and they were asking America, do you want the axe murdering, knuckle-dragging Neanderthals to whack all the trees down, or do you want to send us $20 and we'll save the forest? Well, the public doesn't want all the trees cut down, so they funded a conflict industry that is completely mired in the fight. They have to have crisis and conflict in order to make money. So, and we were making them money by being the fighters. We were part of their business strategy. And we finally recognized that we were the third ring of a three-ring circus, and somebody else was taking the gate receipts.
Somebody, and there was a high price. There is a high price that we're paying right now, too, in jobs and in all this carbon going into the air. And we're going to come back and talk about a better way here in just a little bit. But let's go to the past and remember these timber wars of the 90s. Bruce Vinson is with us, co-owner of Environomics and a timber expert out of the Libby area. Back with more Voices in a bit. Public affairs and government affairs and NEPA management and crisis communications and NGO due diligence. That's part of the work that Bruce Vinson currently does as co-owner of Environomics, and it's Environomics USA. For more information, him and his partner Tammy have been doing that since 1992. Speaking of partners, another partner out there that you're really, really sweet on, you guys celebrated an anniversary, Bruce. I'm sorry about mentioning that on the air right now. We're back live, Voices of Montana. But congratulations on the 40th.
Oh, thank you. 45th,
pardon me, yes.
Yeah, that was Saturday. I've got the most awesome mate in the world. And thank heaven she's stuck with me.
Yeah, No, it's speaking of battles, speaking of wars, let's go to the timber wars of the 90s. What did it? I mean, we're in the middle of it. It's hard to see the forest for the trees, to use that cliche. You're in the battle. Now, as you said, you stepped out, you looked, and now we're several decades removed. But I think what we're seeing here is we're reaping what we sowed when it comes to the outcome of those timber wars, if you want to say.
Yeah, we're reaping it in a couple of different ways. One is the tragedy of the truth on the ground in our forest. What we foresaw coming in the late 80s and early 90s, and what we foresaw was an inability to access the forest to remove fuel. And if we weren't managing, nature was going to, and nature's tool is fire. So we're seeing that work itself out now. Fire is being the major manager of national forest land. So that's the downside of what's happened in the last 30 years. The upside is we learned a lot about the difference between fighting and leading. And we're at a point now where we can turn a corner. Now, one of the things we learned in the timber wars, and it was ugly. When it first started, we watched what was going on the West Coast and California, and it was crazy there. And we thought, well, it's crazy in California, but they invented crazy, so it can never happen in Montana. Well, crazy is portable, is what we learned. It started visiting here, and the lawsuits, the litigation and the appeals and the fighting every attempt of the Forest Service to manage the forest started happening here, and we started losing our sawmills and our logging jobs. So it was a really tough time. And in the early days, we thought, all we have to do is tell the public the truth. Well, the truth is a nebulous thing. It depends on which vantage point you have. And we were standing on street corners and screaming the truth at people. What we should have been doing is listening to what the concerns of the public were. What concerns? Because we only operate with the consent of the public. Mm-hmm. It's like every other field of agriculture. If the public doesn't like what we're doing, they will find a way to regulate us into doing what they think is right. What we learned, though, when we were engaging the public is Will Rogers was right. He once said, it ain't what you don't know that's a problem, it's what you know that ain't so that's a problem. And the public knows a lot that just ain't so.
Yes.
About forestry. And they think if we stop managing the forest, it will save it. Well, it's saving it to death. But we started listening to the public and hearing what they were saying. That was after we did a great deal of fighting and participating in the business strategy of the environmental conflict industry, though. And then we started playing what I call reverse jeopardy. We started telling the public what we wanted them to know, answering all the questions they weren't asking, telling them things, the truth. We plant 6 trees for everyone we harvest. We have more forested land in America now than we did at the turn of the last century, because we've been reforesting. But what we didn't discuss with the public was why sometimes if you want the forest to be healthy, you need to start a chainsaw and remove some fuel. So we hurt ourselves a great deal. And by we, I was a leader in that for about a decade. From 1988, when I first got thoroughly involved, until the late 90s, we hurt ourselves because we were screaming at the public instead of listening to what the public was concerned about.
What were some of those concerns legitimately? Now, I know you've stated, and I like that, the tragedy of the truth. It is hard to get information. And the public, yes, we want to give them what the public wants, healthy forests. The public can be fickle, though, and they can be misinformed about a lot of things. And in fact, some groups kind of rely on that. But what were some of those past practices that were legitimately needed to be addressed and then were addressed?
Well, the days of the timber barons were absolutely real. It was socially acceptable to clear-cut huge areas of land because it was economically viable to do it. Ecologically, it made sense in some of the forested areas. but removing all the trees in an area was not understood by the public. That did not look good. So we had to largely give up those practices and instead focus on the forest for ecological health and trying to mimic a management regime that existed before Europeans came, and that was Native American management. So we had to give up some of the practices. We also had to take a look at how we were operating in our watersheds. In the old days, it was not unusual to run equipment through a stream. Well, we fish in those streams. We live next to those streams. We love those streams, and we had to design best management practices in riparian areas. So we had to tackle our own practices and make sure we were doing the right environmental management of the forest that we love. So there are some stream-side management things we had to not give up. We had to change some of the harvesting regimes. We had to take a strong look at them and do what was ecologically right, not just what was economically feasible.
So we've altered some practices, and I've been calling on the environmental community to do the same today. And we're going to come back and talk about that and a lot more here, too. Bruce Vincent is with us, as I mentioned, third-generation logger from Libby, Montana. Got educated just kind of right across the road, so to speak, in Gonzaga with an engineering degree, and now speaks all across the world and has also testified in Congress regarding our forest management practices. So back with more here in just a bit, and we have Eric Young with headlines today. Back with Bruce Vincent, Tom Schultz alongside here on Voices of Montana. This is from EPA Facts. Go to the website, a website if you're interested in this. Collusion with environmental activists, a report that they put out again, it's EPA Facts. They're not right-leaning, left-leaning as far as I can tell, but this is Sue and Settle. This section here, between 1995 and 2010, taxpayers gave Earth Justice $4.65 million. That's in a five-year period. And as Bruce had talked about, it's part of their industry now. But the issue goes deeper. The EPA has been working hand in hand with environmental activist groups, and where the EPA has used official government events to help these activists obtain signatures for their petitions. And another thing here is you look at how deep it is. In 2008, after President Obama's election, there was a half a dozen staffers with the National Resources Defense Council, one of those groups that is probably, very aggressive. We'll call it I'll just say they're farther to the left of that spectrum. Half a dozen of those staffers from that group went to work in the Obama administration. So Bruce, you're looking at when you're trying to get more responsible forest management practices that should bring a couple of different dividends that both these groups want. You're looking at a pretty long road back, as you mentioned, because of our current situation, as just described.
Yeah, there's an entire industry that has been built on the crisis and fight, and it took us a long time to recognize that. We thought we were just arguing over what the truth is, and what we learned is that there are some people that are making a great deal of money on the fight. And in forestry, one of the biggest changes was the change in the legal world with equal access to justice. And equal access to justice came in that Carter administration. It was a good, well-intended law to level the playing field.
Yep.
And it was so Vietnam vets could take on the Veterans Administration over Agent Orange. But in the late 80s, they modified that bill, that act. They modified it to carve out a special dispensation for environmental litigants. They removed the cap on earnings for the attorneys, and they removed the asset cap. So it used to be if you had $1 million in assets, you couldn't sue the federal government and have them pay your court costs and attorney fees. Well, when they changed that and when they allowed environmental groups to act on behalf of their individuals and they removed the cap on their earnings per hour, they started managing
We'll finish that thought, Bruce, in just a second.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
You're listening to a podcast from the live Voices of Montana radio show. Be sure to check out the full podcast page at voicesofmontana.com for a full listing of all our programs. We've been covering Montana issues for more than 20 years. Thanks for listening today.
Talking about ways we can do better. And it's just, I don't know. When I say the phrase, we can do better, everybody goes, yeah, we can. But getting it across that better line, well, there's, you know, if we just remove the politics. Welcome back. It's From Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana, and Tom Schultz here. Appreciate you making us a part of your Montana mornings for so long, 20-plus years. I don't give out that phone number a lot if you want to text here. We are talking our forests here, and we talked last Thursday, too. I give that bit about how much carbon is going up in the air because our trees are burning. It's more than actually our vehicles are sending up in general. Bruce Vincent is with us here. It's 866-627-5483. That's the phone number to join us for calls or questions, comments, or 781-627-5483. And that's our text line. And Bruce, Bruce is with Environomics, by the way. He's co-owner. That group's been around since 92. He's, let's say just a timber expert. He has testified in Congress. He's been named Timberman of the Year in Montana, National Forest Activist of the Year in the past, 60 Minutes, the Neil Lehrer Hour. And also he does something up there, Provider Pals. Bruce, you've been doing Provider Pals for such a long time. Just thanks for kind of, you know, you're a community guy, aren't you? Thanks for kicking in on that if you want to talk about what that is. And Environomics, too, before we get back to it.
Well, the push behind Provider Pals, which is on sabbatical right now with the way things are around the country, but it was introducing kids in the urban areas to people who provide their stuff, like farmers and ranchers and miners and loggers, and introducing our culture to the urban population. Because we figured out that we only operate with the consent of the public, and the public has no idea what we do for a living and how we're interfacing with them. And we've laughed at what the public doesn't know. I mean, how many of us have said the silly people in the city think milk comes from a carton at Safeway? Well, it's not funny anymore because the conflict industry that is marketing fear, that lack of information on the public's part is a fertile marketing ground for their attempts to get the public to send them $20 a year. So we need to stop laughing at the public for what they don't know and engage the public and talk to them about what we think they need to know in order for us to do the right thing on the ground.
I don't know how we I've talked about it. The Endangered Species Act, the Equal Access to Justice Act, those things are good, but they are being willfully misused for this purpose of raising funds. I think that's as plain. I think we can make that statement. There are those who are going to argue with that statement. But how do you put some guardrails on that? Are there solutions out there that are going to, because unless they just voluntarily say, hey, you know what? Just like your conservation group did, we're making a mistake. We are not fixing the problem. We're adding to it. I don't know if they'll voluntarily recognize that.
I think they're going to have to be pushed into a corner to recognize it and be socially unacceptable. Just like our practices that we had to change were socially unacceptable. Them halting the forest management that needs to be done to have a healthy forest has got to be unacceptable to the public. And then maybe we'll change some policies so that they can't earn money on this fight through the courts. And I think the public is ready. Right now, we've got forest ecosystems and watersheds and entire communities burning to the ground throughout the West. And smoke from those fires is blanketing the country. They're smelling forest management in New York City. And what that means is that right now there's an opportunity to talk to the public about management options of the forest that they claim to love. And I think the public is exhausted by the constant and shrill battle cries of warring parties. On forestry issues, they're tired of hearing what's wrong and ready to start hearing about what can be right. And that's our open door. And what we've been doing for 20 years now in places like Libby and communities throughout Western Montana is building collaborative processes where we get the previously warring parties that live there sitting at a table and crafting what do we want our forest to look like in 100 years or 200 years? And ultimately, our ability to implement the management regime that's going to yield a healthy, resilient forest, I think the public is ready for that discussion.
I want to talk about some of those specific ways and how that looks. I'm reporting or referencing a handout that is from Lincoln County, Counties on Fire, and this was signed by the three county commissioners there. The news is frightening. 363 million board feet of timber die annually on the Kootenai. And you guys have noted that that equals to like just gallons of gasoline sitting in the forest, right?
Yeah, on the Kootenai, we're one of the lucky forests that we're growing more than is dying right now, barely, but we're still stacking about 226 million gallons of gas around our communities every year. In the state of Montana, statewide, our forests are dying faster than they're growing, and we're stacking almost 3 billion gallons of gasoline, the equivalent of 3 billion gallons of gasoline around our communities every year, because you can't make trees not grow. They're solar powered. They are growing, sucking in carbon dioxide, keeping the carbon in a tube that we call a tree, and giving off oxygen. And what's going on in Montana right now is we're contributing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through rotting forest and forest fires. And ultimately, that's unacceptable to the public. So what we need to do is sit down locally and craft, what do we want it to look like in 100 years? And figure out how to manage it for that. A lot of that, by the way, Tom, is going to be looking at how the Native Americans managed.
They
used fire. My valley was burned every 10 to 12 years because the trees were not the friend of the Native Americans. The things they ate didn't eat trees. They ate grass and shrubs, and it was hard to travel through the trees. It was hard to see their enemy, hard to see their prey. So they managed the forest with fire for thousands of years. When white Europeans came to our forest, there were 50 or 60 trees to the acre. Since we removed the Native Americans and their management largely from the landscape, we've ended up with a forest that doesn't have 50 or 60 trees. It's got 600 trees to the acre. And trees are water pumps. A pine tree in the Rocky Mountains sucks 200 to 300 gallons of water out of the ground a day. And if you have too many water pumps, the forest becomes stressed, it becomes ripe for insect infestation, other diseases, and then it dies. And that's what we're looking at, wholesale mortality on our forest because we've got too many water pumps. And sitting down with the public and determining how do we remove some of those and protect our forests, protect our watersheds, protect our endangered species habitat, protect our communities, and generate an economy on that.
Yeah.
That's the key to the future.
Yeah, because this is a resource. How do we do that? What works? What doesn't? You know, I know that you're not going to maybe look at EJA and ESA. There's not enough will in Congress to make changes to that. I'm not sure that our counties and our governors have enough local authority, but there's some there. The fast tracking has sort of worked a little bit. Senator Tester has proposed certain specific, or at least these are listed in the infrastructure. And I kind of want to go through those a little bit. But short of EJA and ESA alterations, modifications, what is going to work out there, both from an economic and an environmental standpoint?
The first step we need to take, and that's the step that Lincoln County is taking right now, is prioritize the areas that need managed so that we don't turn into Greenville, California, that burned to the ground a couple days ago,
yeah,
or Paradise, California, a city the size of Missoula that burned to the ground a couple of years ago. What we need to do is focus on those areas around our communities. They call it the wildland-urban interface. And there are a number of tools that Congress has given the managing agencies, the Forest Service, to use to manage the urban interface, the acres within a half mile of our town, so that at least there's a chance when that fire comes through that we have a defensible space and we can keep from burning our towns down. So we're focusing on just that. The wildland-urban interface is, it doesn't get litigated as much as the stuff out in the landscape. It is critically important to the future of our towns. It is our last line of defense when the fire comes out of the landscape. And included in the bill that the Senate is moving forward right now is a great deal of money to help empower that process. I think there's $500 million, $500 million to support community-led efforts to improve community wildfire readiness and removing vegetation. I think that's going to be critical in places, particularly in western Montana, where our communities are right in the forest. Libby is surrounded by 2.5 million acres of national forest. And we need to prioritize the areas that make our communities at risk. So in Lincoln County, we're doing what's called a shared stewardship proposal. When you get into the wildland-urban interface, you have private property owners, you have state land, you have national forest land. We're working on an agreement between all the owners and the 135,000 acres of wildland-urban interface to prioritize those areas that need managed. And to do that in a continuing basis, because once we get done removing the vegetation to protect our communities, what do you know? The trees are still growing, so we're going to have to continue doing that.
Well, I need to take a break here, and then I kind of want to go into this just a little bit, because as you noted, $500 million in this infrastructure bill. There are other spending projects. You're a guy who knows what that looks like on the ground. So prioritize. Take care of the wildland-urban interface, and we'll come back and look at more solutions instead of breathing it here on Voices of Montana. You can learn a lot in a little conversation with Bruce Vincent. He's been battling, or I shouldn't say battling, but he has been advocating for forest management and our forests and our logging communities for a long time. Third generation logger from Libby. Tom Schultz back here. Just a few more minutes, Bruce. And so I'll try to fast track this one a little bit. There's some money in this infrastructure bill. It's noted here in a few different places. $500 million for mechanical thinning and timber harvest to promote fire resilient stands. That's what we need in the forest. If we see people working in the forest and they've got whatever it is they're doing, it's a chainsaw or it's a bulldozer or maybe they're just out there with a clipboard, how will we know that what they're doing out there is good taxpayer expenditures? What's going to work out there?
Largely what's going to work is removing the fuel so that we can reintroduce natural fire. If we reintroduce it before we remove the fuel, we end up with huge catastrophically hot fires that don't do good things. So when the public sees the increasing management that we need, and that means some mechanical removal, some prescribed burning, it's not pretty to look at. But what I ask them to do is visualize the charred remains of homes in California that we're looking at right now, and that's what we're trying to avoid. We need to remove fuel. People are understanding that. We don't need to take big trees. We need to remove the little trees that are causing the conflagrations that we're staring at right now. So I encourage the public to learn more about how forests work. They can go to the Evergreen Magazine website, www.evergreenmagazine.com.
Why that one? Is that a good one? Evergreen?
Evergreen.
What?
For 30 years, they've been trying to take white papers put out by the University of Montana or the U.S. Forest Service and turn it into English that's understandable to the public. So strongly encourage them to go look at that site. And they have a section right now called Counties on Fire, and it's specifically addressing the options we face as we move forward and try to do the right thing for the forest and our forest communities. I also encourage people to read 1491 by Charles Mann. It's a vigorous discussion of what pre-existed Columbus, including forest management in the Rocky Mountains. So I encourage people to take a look, because a lot of what we're going to try to do is mimic the cycle of management that was here before Western Europeans showed up, because it was a vigorous, vibrant, healthy, fire-resilient forest that was here when white guys showed up. So I encourage folks to read that. It's a great look at what pre-existed Columbus. And then I ask them to, if they have time, understand the forest around them. And if they're a private landowner, take a look at the tools that are available. And this infrastructure bill is going to put some money towards doing the right thing on your 5 acres. There's help out there if you own some acreage and you want to make it fire-wise or fire-safe. There's a great deal of information. There are a number of different tools that can be used. And I think the public is ready. They're tired of the doom and gloom, bongo drum beating, incense burning, planet is dying crap that they have been getting since they were 5 years old. They're ready for a new vision. A new vision of environmentalism. Built on hope instead of fear, science instead of emotion, education instead of litigation. It's our job as rural communities to give them that new vision. That's how we're going to have a future.
Nice words to conclude with, Bruce. Appreciate that. We'll catch up again, okay, sir?
All right. Thanks, Tom.
You guys take care. We'll see you Tuesday.